When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds, and Republicans want to raise the retirement age to 70. We have a jam-packed show today. Senator Tammy Baldwin talks with us about the next steps in expanding healthcare in America. Then Yahoo News senior correspondent Michael Weiss will fill us in on the implications of Biden sending tanks to Ukraine. But first, we have the Daily Beast congressional reporter Sam Brody. Welcome to Fast Politics, Sam Brody.
Thank you. Great to be back.
What the fuck is happening in Congress? This is the kind of thing they ask on NPR all the time. What the fuck? But I want to talk about a photo that I saw yesterday. Representative Corey Mills from Florida, of course, passing out grenades to House members. It has a little elephant on it. What the fuck is happening, man?
Molly, it's not a live grenade, so it's really fine.
Yeah.
No, I saw that and it was like, there's a metaphor here somewhere. And maybe when it comes to the debt limit later on, we'll look back on this grenade moment as something, you know, symbolically poignant. I think the grenade thing is actually such a perfect encapsulation of how the House Republican conference has changed. And I want to maybe take a beat to fill in folks about this guy, Corey Mills, who was just elected to a Republican House seat in Central Florida. He's part of this new crop of members who kind of came on my radar last year as the elections and primaries were happening, of like folks who are sort of going to join the expanded like Marjorie Taylor Greene wing of the Republican Party.
So you mean complete lunatics?
Yeah, I mean, like, for example, so this guy, his sort of backstory, I think, is super interesting in terms of like the kind of person now that's elected to Congress from the Republican Party. His claim to fame is that he runs a business that manufactures police munitions.
Okay. Guns.
Specifically,
bullets.
Yeah, well, tear gas, rubber bullets, things like that. And this is something that he ran on like in his primary, and he did an ad where he like, you know, basically ran footage of like Black Lives Matter protesters and press getting tear gassed. And he was like, you know, this was supposed to be a reason to vote for him. And he had this joke about, if you and the media don't like it, like, I'll make you cry in a different way. And it's like cuts to people being tear gassed. So that's this guy's background. He was elected to Congress.
He seems great. Because nothing funnier than using violence against people protesting, then
tear gassing people. It's super funny. And I think in the past, or even maybe now, you had members who kind of played the role of like the Republican culture warrior, but didn't come from that. And they had boring jobs before being elected to Congress, like being a lawyer, a state lawmaker, or a dentist. And now you have people like Corey Mills, who are like, no, his job was to make tear gas. And now he's in Congress.
He sounds like a great, great candidate. I'm sure he's not going to default on the debt and cause American credit to plummet and ruin our economy. So I want to ask you, who else is in this MAGA crew?
Yeah, it's an expanded crew. And I think the McCarthy vote actually changed the way that I thought about this. So there was a set of, like Corey Mills, for example, comes in and he was a reliable supporter of Kevin McCarthy, voted for Kevin McCarthy on every ballot. And then there were people in the more, I think, like obvious anti-McCarthy camp in this kind of new crop of MAGA representatives. So Ana Paulina Luna, also from Florida. That's going to be a recurring theme here is Florida, but
yeah, I'm shocked because
Luna, like a true MAGA influencer before she got to Congress, and she
right Turning Point USA type, right?
Precisely, voted against McCarthy. This guy, Andy Ogles, who is from Tennessee, and also, I mean, he was like a county executive, but also used like really, I mean, crazy rhetoric around January 6th and has put out there that the Dobbs decision meant that Congress needed to take action, you know, restricting gay marriage, like stuff like that. He also was anti-McCarthy. But there is kind of interesting stuff like this guy, Eli Crane from Arizona, freshman, not really on anyone's radar at all, like super conservative, actually flipped a district that was held by a Democrat. And he like came out of nowhere and voted against McCarthy every single ballot.
Why?
That is something that people on the Hill have tried to figure out. And the weird thing is McCarthy like spent heavily to elect this guy. His PAC spent almost $1 million to help him win. And then he gets to Congress and, you know, is making life very difficult for Kevin McCarthy. The best answer that anyone has really seemed to come up with was that he sort of promised his constituents that he would support new leadership in Washington. And he actually stuck to that instead of a lot of people who say that and then get to Washington and go, okay, well, I'm just going to do whatever. And so the dude just decided to, yeah, make his first move, really pissing off the leader of his party. So interesting play. We'll see what happens for him.
What's interesting in my mind is that a lot of these people pissed off McCarthy, didn't vote for him. And then we have a situation where McCarthy made 40% of these committees are actually Freedom Caucus guys. He rewarded them for voting against him.
Exactly. He did. You know, there was a lot of kind of speculation about like, were people like Matt Gaetz or others asking for like specific committee assignments? Like, I want the gavel on this subcommittee, which is like essentially amounting to blackmail. Like, I'm not going to vote for you until you give me like this shiny thing that I want for myself, as opposed to like broader rules changes. But it's really remarkable now that we see the committee assignments, what McCarthy gave up.
He clearly gave up a lot, and clearly he did, in fact, do that. But he also gave people like Matt Gaetz never voted for him. Matt Gaetz only ever voted present at the end. I mean, everybody got everything they wanted except the people who towed the line and did what McCarthy asked.
Yeah, status quo for them and the people who held out. I mean, if you're trying to rein in this group, I don't know how anyone who saw what happened with McCarthy now goes, well, I'll be rewarded for towing the line. We'll see how the Congress plays out. But I mean, you look at the Rules Committee, which is an insanely powerful committee on the Hill. They are the gatekeepers to what gets on the floor.
You put Tom Massey on that.
You put Tom Massey on that committee. I mean, you have three Freedom Caucus members now at the table.
Three Freedom Caucus members and Tom Massey, who is, I want to just explain this for the people who are like, you know, my dad, who is very politically knowledgeable, but doesn't maybe know who Tom Massey is. He is a libertarian and he's been known as sort of Mr. No.
He votes no on basically every bill.
Right. Didn't he vote no on disaster relief for his own state in order to sort of prove a point?
Oh, yeah. He's voted no on every disaster relief thing. The House passed by a vote of 420-1 this week, a resolution expressing solidarity with the protesters in Iran. Below no vote, Thomas Massie, just because he can.
So, I mean, that guy's in the rules committee. I mean, how does that work? Explain to me, because doesn't rules set everything up for the whole Congress?
Basically, I mean, so obviously the committees can advance legislation, but it's up to rules to decide how and when and in what form they get to the floor. I mean, it's insanely influential, and it has long had a reputation as the collection of members who are closest to the leadership. It is the leadership committee. They are the literal gatekeepers for what gets onto the floor. And a lot of the times, rules can be sort of a venue for fights that may play out in the broader Congress about various bills. And it's this like freewheeling committee, and they don't really have rules on time limit for speaking. They just kind of do their thing and debate and do whatever. And so the idea behind, for the Freedom Caucus people, getting more of their people on this committee was that they could essentially exercise something close to a veto power on bills before they even get to the floor. Now, the McCarthy people say, well, we put all these guys on the committee, which means, you know, we'll keep the fighting limited to that committee. If it gets out of rules, it means it can pass in the broader Congress. But I think that's a really sunny way to view this when you put a guy on that committee who votes no literally on everything. And Massie has said, I know that people are going to have different views on bills than me, and I'm not going to hold everything up. But it's uncharted territory. It really is.
I don't know how this helps McCarthy. I mean, it almost feels like McCarthy is setting himself up. I wanted to ask this question to you because I feel like this is important. One of the things you could love or you could hate Nancy Pelosi, but it feels like Nancy Pelosi is really like Kevin McCarthy has shown why Nancy Pelosi in a million different ways. Like, this is not the same at all, but there were Democrats who were, I mean, Democratic Party is a Big Ten party with a lot of people with a lot of different ideas. But there were Democratic Congress people who had very different ideas than Nancy Pelosi in many, many ways. But those people were not able to hold up a leadership vote. And, you know, the people who crossed her were punished.
That's right. And it's so hard to compare because McCarthy, at least for now, has proven himself to be a relatively weak leader. And we're comparing him to Nancy Pelosi, who's probably, just in terms of like raw power, the strongest and most effective congressional leader of modern times. I mean, the top fundraiser. I mean, she controlled the campaign apparatus. It was understood that if you crossed her, it was not going to end up well for you. And that enabled Democrats to, at various points, the first time she was speaker and the second time, to get a ton of stuff done because she could keep everyone together. But I also think it's important to note, like, this kind of stuff pissed Democrats off all the time. I mean, I cannot tell you the amount of grumbling that I heard from Democrats over the Pelosi years who, like, were obviously admiring of her and her abilities and her ability to whip votes and get stuff done. But like the legislative process was so isolated in her hands, basically.
Yeah.
And they felt that even committee chairs were like, I'm basically irrelevant, you know. And occasionally this blew up over the past couple of years where chairs would, you know, just totally vent to the media about how little power they felt they had. And so, you know, McCarthy's going to try something different. And to be honest with you, like, some of these changes that he's made, this is going to get super nerdy, but I do think it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
For the first time ever in the last 6 years, I believe, the House is doing open amendments. That means like anybody can file an amendment and get to vote on it. This is not really super good for McCarthy because Democrats can file amendments on bills and give themselves influence on what happens on the floor. This is not something that Nancy Pelosi allowed. She did not allow it for a reason. But McCarthy made this move because his members are clamoring for it. It could help Democrats, but he's like, all right, I'm going to have to roll with this idea of making the House more decentralized. It may sound good right now. It may make everyone feel kind of happy, but it's going to be a real test to see if they can do much of anything in any time with these changes.
I mean, it's just sort of ridiculous. Now, talk to me about this California Senate race.
Oh, the California Senate race is going to be, it's going to be crazy.
Yeah. I mean, who's in already?
So Adam Schiff and Katie Porter are in officially. Okay. I imagine these folks will be very familiar to your listeners.
Yes.
Potentially getting in, to likely getting in, is Barbara Lee, who is a longtime congresswoman from Oakland and Berkeley up in the Bay Area. And she's told colleagues that she's getting in. And I understand it's kind of all but a formality that she's going to get in. It's just a question of timing. I think those are going to be the heavy hitters from the field. Ro Khanna had been mentioned as a candidate, the congressman also from the Bay Area.
Yeah, he's been on this podcast a bunch of times.
I sense that he probably is not going to do it. He's kind of said publicly that he was going to wait on what Barbara Lee did. And if she runs, I think it's unlikely that he runs. Those are three really heavy hitters. Barbara Lee is not as widely known, but she's like an institution in Congress. She was the lone person to vote against the AUMF authorizing like the war on terror after 9/11. I mean, she's as progressive as they come. So like, these candidates aren't going to be that different. It's really vibes, you know, what they choose to focus on, what their brands are.
I want to ask you one question. Explain to me, DeFi is still toying with running again?
No, there's been reporting out there about people sometimes go up to DeFi and ask her stuff in the halls, and she'll give the answer that she gives. And oftentimes her staff comes in to play cleanup or whatever and clarify whatever it is that she just said. No, I don't think anyone is realistically entertaining the idea that she runs again. I mean, it's just not going to happen. I do think what is happening is that she feels that, you know, she has earned the right to go out on her own terms. And she's an institution. She's a legend in politics. And, you know, that she doesn't want to feel rushed in making the announcement. Yet people are not waiting for her, obviously, to make that call. But I don't think anyone is seriously like, oh, you know, she might run again. And she's, you know, it was reported that she said she might make the decision next year, but I think it's worth noting that the filing deadline for this race is this year. It's December 2023.
So we'll know.
We will know.
What other Senate races are you watching?
Well, I think the California thing, just to make one point, is like, obviously this is going to be a Democratic seat, but it's going to suck a lot of Democratic money. It's going to produce a progressive Democrat. And so there's a lot of other states where, I mean, you know, the Democratic map in 2024 is terrible. It's absolutely terrible. They're defending seats in West Virginia, Montana, Ohio, and then also trying to win in Arizona, Michigan, Pennsylvania. These are difficult states to win.
Though Democrats did win in Arizona and Pennsylvania.
That's correct. And I think they would be favored to win these states again. But these are hard states. They're just always difficult states.
Right. But you're going to need a Donald Trump to help with candidate picking. That's the secret to Democratic success.
Right. Well, so here's, I guess, a few brief points to make about, I think, something to watch as we kind of get into the who starts to run phase of the campaigns. The new chair of the Republican Senate campaign arm, Steve Daines from Montana, is basically, he's not explicitly said this, but their goal is to prevent a rerun of 2022, where Washington Republicans saw these candidates emerge out of Republican primaries, like Blake Masters, you know, who were not going to win, but they were like, oh, the voters decide, this is great. And of course, these happen to be the people that Trump liked. Now, they are not ruling out meddling in some of these primaries to produce candidates that are going to stand a chance of winning.
Yeah, good luck to them.
This is going to be the question, is like, that Republican establishment and operative class is eager to apply the lessons from 2022. Are voters in the Republican Party going to apply the lessons from 2022?
No. The RNC is having a bit of a leadership fight. Explain to our listeners what's happening there, because it is fucked up.
It is really crazy. And I think it's been remarked that for a post that is increasingly unimportant in politics.
Yeah. And largely superficial.
Largely superficial. And
I was going to say ceremonial, largely ceremonial.
Yeah. I mean, it is, it's less and less and less important now. And Ronna McDaniel is probably going to win. I don't want to say that she's, you know, but she's pegged as the favorite. Yet it's become this kind of weird airing of various grievances and kind of a proxy war. Again, not so. It is truly a vibes race.
Right. A proxy war of DeSantis versus Trump. But one of the candidates is pro-Trump and is being supported by DeSantis.
Right. Exactly. That's what makes it so weird. And honestly, makes it a little instructive is how the 2024 dynamics could go should Trump and DeSantis be competing with each other. And there's all these like crossed wires of loyalties. And I think DeSantis backing Dylan is probably a reflection of him wanting to differentiate himself from Trump a little bit. But these people all come from the same sort of bucket, right? I mean, Dylan is saying that there needs to be a change in leadership, and this is a leadership that has not brought wins for the Republican Party, yet they continue to kind of center around Donald Trump, who is the reason that, that Republicans are one of the big reasons that Republicans did so poorly in 2022. I think the key thing is that there isn't an actual discussion that seems to be happening about what this race is about and what the Republican Party needs to be doing better. They just think that they need to be winning more,
right?
Which is, of course, sure. But there doesn't seem to be a real discussion about how they're going to do that. And instead, you know, they're flinging oppo at each other. And, you know, Mike Lindell is involved for some reason that no one really knows.
Always happy to see Mike Lindell involved in something.
It's a pillow fight. So,
Sam Brody, thanks so much. I hope you'll come back.
Yes, anytime, anytime.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to think, I'm covered, no worries, right? Well, not so fast. What about your out-of-pocket costs? That can be a lot of money for you and your family. And if you're like me, you can't help but wonder, was I overbilled? You're not alone. It's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. Unless you're a billing expert, how do you know your medical bills are accurate? That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? It's a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance. When your medical claims come in, HealthLock technology reviews the claims for errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden errors, so you pay only what you owe. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. Bottom line, insurance alone isn't enough. HealthLock finds medical bill errors before you pay. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Tammy Baldwin is a junior senator from Wisconsin. Welcome to Fast Politics, Senator Tammy Baldwin.
I'm delighted to join you.
Well, I'm delighted to have you. And I was thinking, first thing I wanted to ask you was like, just do a victory lap for codifying same-sex marriage, please.
Absolutely. You know, I had so many journalists coming up to me during the course of those negotiations saying, do you really think you could do this? I mean, this would be unheard of just less than a decade ago. And I'm like, I really feel like this is within our reach. But what I will say is, since it passed, since the president signed it into law, the responses I've gotten from people impacted, almost to a one, people who well up with tears and talk about what this means to them. And, you know, the running the whole gamut from a young person who said, this is the first time I've ever felt seen by the federal government. And another who is a dear friend who had some really scary health news that he shared with me. And he said, you know, I hope I'm going to overcome this. But just knowing that if I don't, my husband is going to be able to inherit. Stuff that, yeah, you realize how important this is. It was a big deal. So victory lap.
Yeah. I mean, really, it's funny because it's like when it was going on, I thought, this is nice, but it's not, they're never going to be able to do it. You know, I just thought, because, and I wanted to ask you this question, which was, Democrats were unable, and I don't even want to say Democrats, because I actually don't think Roe is a Democratic issue. I actually think it's like same-sex marriage, that it's like a just sane people issue, but didn't even get close to being codified.
That's right. I'm very involved in that. Also, I'm the co-lead on the Women's Health Protection Act, which codifies Roe and takes the additional necessary step of telling states they can't undermine it so that it's, you know, hollow and meaningless. What was happening even before the Supreme Court had overturned it, there were so many states that had really so restricted the access to abortion care and reproductive rights that in essence, it didn't really exist for so many. But in any event, I do think since there are now nearly or a little over a million same-sex married couples, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands or millions of interracial couples there are, but, you know, this came up at a moment where I can't imagine that I have any colleagues who don't know a neighbor, a fellow churchgoer, a person on their staff, somebody, you know, at their grocery store who's married to a same-sex partner or in an interracial marriage. And so it has that capacity of changing hearts and minds. And while I would have liked to have seen a few more Republican hearts and minds change in the final total, to have a dozen, you know, got the job done.
I wanted to ask you, do you think that there's a chance that there'll be a moment to be able to codify Roe, or do you think that ship sailed?
Oh, I certainly do. But if you're talking about, you know, in the near term, I think that's very unlikely. I reflect oftentimes of how long the opposition to Roe worked to organize, to come at it from every angle to try to reverse it. And it took nearly 50 years, but at this juncture, they have succeeded. I don't think it's going to take 50 years to restore comprehensive reproductive rights in America. That said, it's certainly not going to happen overnight. And I think about it in sort of two different ways. One is, I hail from the state of Wisconsin.
Right.
Wisconsin has the oldest criminal abortion statute in the country. It was passed 1 year after we became a state in 1849.
Jesus.
Yeah. No women in the legislature. In fact, women couldn't even vote. You know, we're talking about a state strategy as well as talking about a national strategy, and we have to implement it. We only have 51 Democrats in the Senate, and we know currently that two of them are unwilling to reform the filibuster. So we don't get there this 2 year term, but, you know, we pick up some seats. Who knows?
Right. You hail from the state of Wisconsin, a state that we on this podcast have talked a lot about, especially because your governor got reelected by, it's a very tight state, Wisconsin. I'm not telling you anything that you're not very aware of, but your governor got reelected by 4 points. Your other senator is Ron Anon. I mean, how strange.
It is. People ask me a lot. This same electorate, right, arguably, has interesting outcomes. I mean, look also at the presidential race. Trump narrowly won Wisconsin in 2016, and Biden narrowly won Wisconsin in 2020. And who knows what's going to happen in 2024? We are a closely divided state. And that means on the electoral front, you know, it's about turning out the vote.
Right. 2024. Do you have something you'd like to tell me?
I am widely expected to run for election. I've got to get that announcement on the calendar soon, because every then interview I do, it's like, well, this isn't how we plan to roll it out.
All right. Widely expected is a good line. I wanted to ask you about a legislation you're doing now in Wisconsin, and this goes to Roe. I mean, this goes to rural hospitals. This goes to like really a thing that Americans are struggling with, which is our healthcare costs. And you are working on an expansion legislation. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So probably the most critical and crucial time we've faced to remove any obstacle to getting healthcare coverage has been during a pandemic. We actually took some really bold actions to significantly assist people who were purchasing their health insurance through the Obamacare, through the Affordable Care Act marketplace. So those were its additional assistance. And so far, we've managed to have that assistance last for the next 2 years. However, I believe that this should always be a goal. Obviously, during a deadly pandemic, it's really super important, but it's super important every day for people to have access to affordable, high-quality healthcare. And so one of the things I'm doing with colleagues is introducing legislation that will make the supplement to help people pay for their premiums permanent. That will really help. We've seen just a significant increase, you know, in the millions among people who have secured healthcare in recent years. And of course, there's so much more we have to do. We're just preparing our hearing agenda for the HELP committee that I sit on. What does HELP stand for? Health, education, labor, and pensions. I've been a member of that committee since I joined the Senate. And a lot more that we can do to bring down costs. And by the way, let's also do another victory lap while we're talking about successes. Last year, in the Inflation Reduction Act, for the first time, Medicare is going to be negotiating with the big pharmaceutical companies to bring down prescription drug costs. And if you're a senior on Medicare, there's a cap on insulin. If that right. If you depend on insulin, you will pay no more than $35 out of pocket for insulin. Vaccines, many, many vaccines will now be free without any sort of copay for people who are on Medicare. So just we've had some real breakthroughs in 2022, but more needs to be done.
I mean, I feel like insulin is like one of the great scandals of our time, is that we have people in this country dying because they can't afford to get their insulin. Originally, this administration really wanted, and there was a big push for this idea of having $35 insulin for everyone. I mean, does that seem any way in the cards or no?
I think it still could be. We came very close, but
yeah,
we didn't have enough support from Republicans.
Insane.
In order to get this done. There was a vote in the Senate on whether to extend it beyond the Medicare program. You know, nearly a third of Americans are pre-diabetic or diabetic, and that's a lot of people who yeah. will rely on insulin at some point in their lives. Insulin has been around for over 100 years. It's not like the recipe changes.
Right.
And it's not like the ingredients have become more costly.
It's like EpiPens.
Exactly. Because they can't. No one can follow the dollars. You know, show me the money. Show me where it goes. If you double the price of an EpiPen or of insulin, whose pocket does that go into? We don't even know the answers to those questions. It's just so opaque. So yes, we have more we can do. And I think especially given with insulin in particular, the numbers of families impacted by it, we need to leverage their voices to get my Republican colleagues working on this. And we do have a couple of Republicans. Susan Collins worked hard to try to get an insulin bill, working closely with a number of Democrats, but we need more of them.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's so many ways in which to help working people that Republicans are not interested in, but they still manage to get those votes.
Yeah, well, it's easier to block things in Congress than it is to pass them. And so, especially in the United States Senate, you can't run for a Senate as I have and not be a hopeful person, right? You know, you got to believe that this process can work. You know, we just talked about a number of milestone victories last year.
I mean, one of the things with the Obama administration that was a complaint was that as much as they did a lot of incredible stuff, and Obama is amazing, obviously, that he had some trouble working with the Senate. And there's a sort of quiet way in which the Biden administration has actually passed a ton of legislation.
Absolutely. And, you know, obviously, both President Obama and President Biden were former senators. But when he was senator, Biden really was somebody who understood every facet of how it works and how to move things through, and had hallmark legislation that he was responsible for. So I do think that rubs off in the administration.
Do you have any faith that the CHIPS Act, which is like the, I'm one of the few people who's interested in the CHIPS Act, so everyone has to bear with me here, but that the CHIPS Act could bring back manufacturing to the United States in a way that we haven't seen a government push towards that, and that that could affect your state?
Oh, absolutely. And I was really proud to work on putting together the CHIPS and Science Act. I think the really key areas in which it can bring jobs back to a state like Wisconsin has to do with the supply chain piece of it. We make things in Wisconsin still. We're one of the lead states in manufacturing, have nearly 20% of our workforce is engaged in manufacturing. That's, again, that makes us one of the leads in the country. And yet we have been affected by the supply chain issues where we might produce, say, agricultural equipment, but the microchip, the control panel, is produced overseas. And so you see, you'll actually go to a company in Wisconsin like Kuhn, where you'll see the farm implements the outside the factory ready to go, except they don't have a control panel in them.
Right.
And we see that across the board. So when we use the Commerce Department to start identifying, well, where are those gaps? And it's not just microchips, there's other supply chain issues. And then you start looking with our deep knowledge of who makes what in Wisconsin and across the country. It's like, well, maybe you could make that component and grow your business, add to your list of products, and fill in some of those gaps that we have in our supply chain. You know, I know in some of our larger manufacturers in Wisconsin, they have suppliers, hundreds of suppliers throughout the state, but, you know, they could have just a handful that are from overseas, and it can stop up the whole works. So that's one way in which I think the CHIPS and Science Act is really going to help us bring back jobs. The other thing is something that I've worked on for years and I'm seeing more and more success is just saying, if we're going to spend taxpayer dollars to make something, to buy something, let's make sure that those dollars are spent in the U.S. on U.S. products and workers.
Right.
It just seems like a no-brainer to me. And so I think the more we do in that regard, the more we'll see good paying jobs come back. The infrastructure bill, we got strong Buy America language in that. So we're not going to be using rebar that was sourced out of the country in our infrastructure project. We're going to be making it here and employing more people.
Tammy Baldwin, I really appreciate you joining us. This was great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I know you, our dear listeners, are very busy, and you don't have time to sort through the hundreds of pieces of punditry each week. This is why every week I put together a newsletter of my five favorite articles on politics. If you enjoy the podcast, you will love having this in your inbox every Friday. So sign up at fastpoliticspod.com and click the tab to join our mailing list. That's fastpoliticspod.com. Michael Weiss is a senior correspondent at Yahoo News. Welcome to Fast Politics, Michael Weiss.
Thanks for having me back, Molly.
Explain to us what the hell is happening in the war in Ukraine.
They're getting tanks. I mean, that's
good.
Kind of
that's
the top
good.
Line, isn't it? Yeah, no, look, it's Jesus. The last month has been quite insane, even by Ukraine war standards. Just trying to dig into the whole will they, won't they, the German fandango about supplying their own model Leopard 2s or allowing other third-party countries, of which there are over a dozen in Europe, to supply Leopard 2s to Ukraine. If I had to sort of summarize the situation, it was we did a bit of a drug deal with the Germans. They kind of conditioned their releasing of the Leopards on our sending Abrams tanks to Ukraine, which is something we didn't want to do for a variety of reasons, most of them logistical, nothing really anymore to do with Putin and his phantom red lines. That argument seems to be greatly diminished in this White House, much to my delight. But yeah, look, basically Schultz said, you first. Perhaps he thought America wouldn't do it. And if that's the case, well, Biden called his bluff and now we're sending Abrams tanks. And this number that's getting bandied about 31, I'm hearing from sources on the inside that actually by the time Abrams get to Ukraine, you can expect that figure to grow. Perhaps even exponentially. So it's not going to be just 31 tanks from us. It's going to be more than that. And there's, you know, recovery vehicles, which are like tow trucks for these tanks. I mean, these are massive, massive pieces of armor. And they require a lot of upkeep and maintenance, which is the reason guys like Mark Hertling were very skeptical and, in fact, resistant to the idea of sending them. Leopard 2s, more in abundance in Europe, easier to repair and maintain. I mean, to give you one example, the Spanish today, and this is a socialist-led Spanish government, which is kind of remarkable. They've announced they're going to send, I think, upwards of 50 Leopard 2s to Ukraine. And the problem with the Spanish tanks is that they've been sitting in warehouses and they've kind of fallen apart. So they need to be refurbished. But the Spanish seem to think they can do that in a matter of weeks or months. So bottom line, I mean, by the end of March, Ukraine will have its first fleet of Western tanks, which is necessary for combined arms maneuver, which is necessary for any major counteroffensive, particularly one that they're going to try and undertake in the south, which is largely steppes, and you're going to need heavy armor if you want to push the Russians back from areas like that. So the next item on the agenda from Ukraine is going to be fighter jets, F-16s they're gunning for, no pun intended.
So here's my question. One of my kids is very into military, and so he has been explaining to me the problems with this scenario.
Yeah.
And this is good because this is really one of the places I'm the weakest. But he explained to me some of the problem here is that now Ukraine has like a lot of different kinds of tanks.
Right.
And that you then have to train people to do, these are not like driving a Escalade. They're like driving a real machine, and that you have to train people to drive these different tanks. And also that the mechanism for taking care of these weapons is complicated. So can you talk to us about that problem?
Yeah, I mean, to put it in kind of the simplest terms possible, you know, the Ukrainians are very well trained and very kind of comfortable with Soviet era Russian-made tanks. And what they've been getting in abundance thus far is exactly that. You know, T-72s, Morocco has sent a bunch of these tanks, believe it or not. Other countries, former Warsaw Pact nations, Poland, Slovakia have sent. The Poles have been, I think, first among equals in sending heavy armor from that period. But, you know, there really is no comparison between these old Soviet relics and modern NATO standard tanks. So your son is right. We're sending Challenger 2s, which is the British model, Leopard 2s, which is the German model, and Abrams. I think it's the more advanced model of the Abrams. I have to double check. My brain is very fatigued after the last 2 weeks. So yeah, driving one is not like driving the other, right? They're fundamentally different platforms, and you know, all of the stuff that goes into keeping them operational. One of the excuses the Biden administration was coming up with for why they didn't want to send the Abrams is that they kept saying, oh, it runs on jet fuel.
Isn't jet fuel the same fuel as everything?
I mean, the Abrams actually is a multi-fuel turbine engine, so it can run on not just jet fuel, but diesel, but it doesn't get very good mileage to the gallon, right? So it's right. A gas guzzler. Essentially, that's the real argument against. And, you know, you could say, well, the Americans wield these devices pretty well in conventional war. Why can't the Ukrainians? I mean, yeah, but the Americans, it took about 10 years to become completely comfortable with this new model of armor. So, I mean, look, the good news is this. If the last 11 months has taught us anything in terms of security assistance and military absorption rates, the Ukrainians are fast learners. Because this is an existential struggle for their very survival and the survival of their nation state, they don't look at this as something leisurely, or they don't look at this as something that they can take their sweet time with. So if you've read some of the reporting that's been done on, for instance, how they trained up on HIMARS or self-propelled howitzers from Western NATO countries, if it's meant to take, say, 8 weeks, they get it done in 5. They don't take lunch breaks. They don't sleep. They just want to learn. because they're so eager to take the fight to the Russians. So that's not to say that we still don't face heavy challenges, and there's going to be a time delay between the announcement of these things and seeing them, you know, blasting away in Kherson or Donetsk. But I think people will be pleasantly surprised by how quickly the Ukrainians adapt, because again, this is just precedent for them. But yeah, no, it's a big deal. And the other side of this, look, I mean, I don't claim any particular expertise in the vagaries of German politics, but one thing I do know is that Olaf Scholz was not a guy who A, foresaw this war coming, B, wanted to be a leader in European arms dealing or arms donating to Ukraine. His famous speech in the Bundestag on February 27th, 3 days after Putin's invasion, was known as the Zeitenwende speech, where he said, okay, we're entering a new phase of European history. Russia has shown itself to be this aggressive, revanchist, imperialist power that's going to literally park tanks on European soil. We must increase our defense spending. Germany must get its house in order. And this is a very kind of robust, almost militaristic speech, very unusual for an heir to the Social Democratic Party in Germany. But he was making this speech with the assumption that Ukraine was going to fall and that Russian hegemony would inch that much closer to Germany's own borders, right? He was taken by surprise by the ferocity of Ukrainian resistance. And I think perhaps also taken by surprise, given America's priors in the last 20 years when it comes to warfare, both indirect and direct, that President Biden would be as bullish and as invested in Ukraine's victory as he was. So the real kind of unsung story of Germany in this war, I mean, well, there are several, but to my mind is, if you look at just the calculus of what Germany has sent in terms of materiel, heavy equipment, and I mean, you know, air defense systems, self-propelled howitzers, light arms, you name it, compared to what they were going to send as of the beginning of the war, 5,000 helmets, remember that. It arguably eclipses even what the United Kingdom has sent Ukraine. It is so staggering, the numbers. The problem is, the Germans don't want to take credit for it. And Olaf Scholz has been so disastrous in his public diplomacy that hardly anybody even within Germany knows this. So the tank issue was this big sticking point. And you know what's ironic is, given Scholz's ideological background, I mean, as a teenager in the 80s, growing up in West Germany, I mean, he was very anti-American. He was almost a fellow traveler of the Soviet Union, took several trips to East Germany. According to the Stasi files on him and his retinue, was advocating that the Soviets park nuclear weapons aimed at the United States in Europe. I mean, he was very much pro-Moscow. And I think for him to say, well, I'm not doing anything till the Americans do it first, I read this kind of amusingly as, you know, a guy whose entire political career was premised on less of America in Europe is now deciding, in order to kind of save his own skin with respect to Germany's electorate and to not be seen to be antagonizing Putin as a, you know, the uber hawk of European politics, is basically crawling back under the American security umbrella and asking for more American leadership, if not American hegemony. So I find that very funny and very ironic, but I'll take it. And from the Ukrainian perspective, the importance about Abrams, even beyond the military capability, which is formidable, I mean, these are good tanks, probably the best in the world, it's that this bespeaks a very long-term investment in Ukraine, not just in terms of a defensive capability, kicking the Russians out and you know, creating a sovereign, independent Ukraine, which, by the way, includes occupied Crimea, includes the occupied territories of the Donbas as of 2014-15. But it's an investment in Ukraine's post-war future. This is a country that, I mean, unless things go horribly wrong for it in the coming year, really is going to be an integral part of Europe. We'll eventually join the European Union. And now you're hearing people such as Henry Kissinger even come out and say, well, it certainly makes sense for them to join NATO after this is all done. So, I mean, this is an extraordinary 180 from where we found ourselves as of January 2021. And that's why they think we'll get fighter jets next. I mean, F-16s have been on, they've been on the table in terms of negotiating with the Americans for quite a while. And to be honest with you, I would class them at slightly higher level than rumor that Ukrainian pilots have already begun to be trained on these airframes. And again, this is a very long-term investment because F-16s are not going to be in play in the next 6 months. They would be probably arriving, if they got them, within the next, we're talking years, I think. So, you know, I mean, look, we're building Ukraine a modernized army and doing it for free. I mean, because they're in extremity. They're not paying for this stuff. And that's okay. I mean, because at the end of this, they're going to be one of the most militarily seasoned and equipped and formidable armies in Europe. And that's just a good American investment in terms of international transatlantic security. Right.
Okay. So I love you. I just want to know, does this go on forever? I mean, when does this ever end?
I would be a fool if I sat here and said, right. So as of April 30th of 2023, the war will be over. Right. I don't know. I mean, nobody knows in war. So all I can say is the metrics that you would want to use to sort of make any kind of tentative forecast suggests that Ukraine has a very good chance. And Ukraine has a very good chance now of also pushing into Crimea, which had been not in consideration as of even a few months ago. You read the New York Times story that the US has now decided to take the gloves off and to allow Ukraine, which is, I read, as giving them the intelligence and also giving them a military capability to punish the Russians in Crimea. You know, the real question is, how long does Putin have and how long does he want to play this out? And from what I understand and where my reporting has taken me, he's shrugging his shoulders. If he knows how badly his army is performing in the battlefield, or he's being misled as to what it's doing, he just doesn't care. He's not driven by considerations of, you know, Russian fatalities, at least not yet. A good friend of mine who just wrote a book on this war and even the sort of lead up to it has gone to Moscow several times since a year ago and tells me, you know, the mood in Moscow is one of utter indifference and obliviousness. Nobody realizes or cares that there's a war going on. So until he feels that this thing is threatening his hold on power, and even then, we don't know what he might calculate. He's just going to pour more manpower into it. Now, the real question is, does he have all the concomitants for war? The hardware, the ammunition, the military industrial complex, can it sustain this in the long term? Well, you're beginning to hear from American officials. I mean, Wendy Sherman came out, what was it, last week, and said, we don't see Putin being able to do another mass mobilization. I just interviewed with an Estonian colleague of mine, a very good Estonian military analyst who I've been relying on since the start of this thing and who's got it, frankly, more or less right on every occasion, who says he does not foresee enough pressure on Putin to undertake another mass mobilization. And he also said, which is interesting, that, you know, everybody in the U.S. is now trying to anticipate the next big Russian counteroffensive. What they don't take into account is that the Russians and the Kremlin probably sees what is taking place now as a massive counteroffensive. So all the energy, all of the raw meat, frankly, thrown into places like Bakhmut and prior to that Soledar, that's for them a big push. So it's interesting. We have different assessments depending on whom you query, but, you know, I can tell you this, the Ukrainians have no flagging resolve or morale. They think they can win. And by win, they think they can push Russia even beyond February 24 borders. They think that they can absolutely retake Crimea. They think they can push them out of the LDNR. And I mean, look, I can also tell you that people who are paid to go to places and collect information, otherwise known as intelligence, including from our country, are very, very optimistic in a way that they had not been up until almost quite recently, I'd say. So take that as you will. You know, again, the U.S. assessment was Kyiv is toast in 72 hours. Now it's Sevastopol might be toast for the Russians before the end of this thing.
I'm going to push back here for 2 seconds.
Go ahead.
And when does this end?
We don't know. I mean, again, you know, Putin can continue to fight a war or a special military operation, which he's only belatedly characterized, I think, once as a quote-unquote war, almost indefinitely. But again, you can be at a state of war by just, you know, calling up 18-year-olds, giving them, you know, ill-fitting, outdated uniforms, giving them rusty carbine rifles with no ammunition, sending them to the battlefield and say, go take this town or city. That's a state of war, but it's not one that's sustainable or one that you can win. So the real question is, when does Putin feel he has been defeated? And when does he feel he can either withdraw and claim some kind of victory, which, you know, if you listen to Timothy Snyder, who's a very good historian of modern Europe and also understands, I think, Russian mindset on a lot of these issues, he wrote an essay several months ago about, you know, Putin's virtual reality dictatorship. The mass population in Russia believes what they see on television, right? They're not reading opposition independent newspapers, which now don't exist in the country, have to go to places like Latvia and Lithuania and Poland. They believe what the TV tells them. And if Putin instructs his talking heads, his you know, apparatchik propagandists on state television to basically say, oh, okay, it's over. We've won. We've degraded the Ukrainian military capability to a point where it's now neutralized. It poses no threat to us. We've humiliated NATO. I mean, they just make stuff up all the time, right? This would not be a new script for them. The people would probably shrug their shoulders and carry on. I mean, they're already doing that, even with 300,000 plus mobics being sent to the front. And by the way, the mobilization that was undertaken a few months ago, and this kind of tells you the kind of regime that Putin is running, that wasn't really targeting ethnic Russians, right? That was targeting the ethnic minority populations in Russia, the people in the regions, the Buryats, the Chechens, the Dagestanis, and so on. So he's sending non-Russians to go fight a war for Holy Mother Russia. So this is a very colonialist enterprise, and usually militaristic and aggressive and chauvinistic colonial enterprises collapse under their own weight. And in this case, I mean, we don't have an empire here that we're dealing with. We have a country whose, I think, GDP, even before the war, was smaller than that of the state of California, and whose military, which was meant to be this bright, shiny new phenomenon that had been built up over the last several years, I mean, is a busted flush. Missiles that don't hit their mark, missiles that are now being intercepted at a rate of, what, 85% as of yesterday? You know, this bombardment of cruise missiles in Kyiv and other regions, I think they shot down 47 out of 55 of them. That's good. And they're getting better all the time, the Ukrainians, thanks to the platforms that we're providing them. So when you say, when does it end? I don't have an answer for you. But I can tell you that the current trajectory suggests it's not going to end the way Russia wants. And the other interesting data point here is, you know, and I heard this ad nauseum at the start of this thing, several cliches. Ooh, a cornered Putin is a dangerous Putin. He's like a rat. You know, he's gonna show his teeth and all that. Well, now you're hearing from U.S. officials. Again, this was quoted in the New York Times. Toria Nuland said this several weeks ago, and it kind of flew under the radar. They don't think that the nuclear threat is nearly as acute as it was several months ago. And according to Nuland, Putin was persuaded that if he were to resort to WMD in any fashion, tactical or whatever, it would be the end for him because he would lose China and he would lose India, the two countries that he has to rely on, with China strategically, but also economically with India. That's good news, which is why every time I see World War III trending on Twitter, every time World War III has trended, I mean, we're up to World War like 89 by now, right? Sending tanks to Ukraine is not going to start another world war. And to be honest with you, I mean, I'm not going to offer my own opinion on this. I'll just tell you, I'm hearing from people who have access to information that I do not. They think that sending F-16s to Ukraine won't even cause a major hiccup in terms of kinetic response from the Russian side. There's a reason, for instance, they're putting Pantsir air defense systems on top of the Ministry of Defense in Moscow and other tall buildings. They're preparing.
Thank you so much for joining us, Michael Weiss.
Sure.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Molly Jong-Fast.
Jesse Cannon.
I hear Mr. Trump's doing some campaigning. What are you seeing there?
A weekend of Donald J. Trump praying over fast food restaurants.
That was so good.
That was amazing.
His hair looked so majestic.
His weave.
Yes, I'm sorry.
It looked incredible. His weave looked
majestic. By that, I mean not at all majestic.
As our moment of fuckery, we're going to say take Donald Trump today, but I actually want to be serious for a minute. He does stupid stuff. He appeals to people who are not intellectuals, maybe, but he needs to be taken deadly seriously. And because, you know, even though it seems like Trump is poison when it comes to swing states, he's still a real danger. And if he gets I guess it would be considered to be reelected, he will end American democracy as we know it. Also, we'll have to deal with more Don Jr., which I personally cannot take. So
I don't know if the cartels can take keeping up that supply either.
You said it. I didn't. But our moment of fuckery is Donald Trump. Don't take him literally. Take him seriously because he's terrifying. That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit HealthLock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.